I don't really have a paper to present, but I have a bit of a story to tell along with some TV segments. And this actually is part of a larger project that I'm just starting to develop on the history of early science television. And I presented aspects of this in collaboration with Dan and Orphan Cinema at the Margaret Mead Film and Video Festival last November. And the larger take is a look at two series, in fact. One was created out of the University of Pennsylvania Museum of Archaeology and Anthropology from the early 1950s called What in the World, which was considered one of the first archaeological quiz shows ever staged in America, with scientists being given an object from the museum's collections, along with a guest celebrity, if you want to call Vincent Price a celebrity. And they would basically play a guessing game on camera for about half an hour. So very simple technique, you know, not high production values, but set within a museum and really celebrating the collections of an institution. And what's interesting with that project, it actually really inspired a young David Attenborough who had seen it, who went back to London and with the BBC created their first science quiz show called Animal, Vegetable, Mineral. And actually, if you Google David Attenborough and that title, you can see some very brief segments from that series from the early 1950s. I'd like to argue that adventure really pushes the field far and wide in that the production values are so much more extraordinary, as I'll show you shortly. And as I mentioned, you know, this is really just the beginning of a process. So I don't have a lot of ways that I'm analyzing at this point. What I'm really trying to do is find people who were involved with that project. So I began with the Museum of the American Museum of Natural History's Special Collections Division within the library to discover that in from 1953 to 1956, the American Museum of Natural History and CBS partnered in a project to basically bring the museum beyond the walls, which in some ways is a really radical concept in that in the late 20, early 21st century, there's so much talk of bringing institutions beyond the walls with through the web, through distance learning. But AM&H was really experimenting with this in the early 1950s. I have been fortunate in being able to track down a couple of the still living producers and art designers, and I really give great thanks to them and want to mention them each by name because they've been the absolute vital force in helping me start this project. The first is Perry Wolfe, who was the producer of the series and subsequently has gone on to produce and direct hundreds of shows primarily for PBS, and he's had a particular emphasis on focusing on art. The other is a name that might be familiar to you, Jack Venza, who created Dance in America. Most of what we've ever seen on PBS related to dance is thanks to Jack Venza, and subsequently he had become the president of WNET in New York. He was just starting out his career when he became involved as an art designer and then associate producer on the Adventure series. And finally, Bernard Birnbaum, who also was an associate producer and involved in a lot of the writing of the Adventure series. And his career trajectory kept him at CBS. And in fact, he was involved with CBS's Sunday Mornings for many, many years. And I'll make another reference to that show as we start talking. The way I'm trying to handle some of this material, because again, it's 120 episodes over 3 years, is to think about it in a variety of ways. And I've broken it into sort of three areas, which I'm going to share just a few clips with you. The first section is scientists on TV, because that represented a lot of what the museum was trying to convey, both from the physical, the natural sciences, and ethnography, anthropology, which ultimately became the most successful way to showcase, because it was about people and cultures and storytelling, and So that's one slice. The second is performing science, and the final is science and celebrity, celebrity on TV, and I'll define a little bit later what I mean by celebrity. And I also want to apologize because all of these screenings have been so fluid, but the way that I've delivered the DVD, it's a lot of segments that I've been working with and showing in other venues, and for purposes of time, there's going to be a little bit of kind of breaking between my talk and elements that I'm not particularly referring to. So if it looks a little funny and funky for moments here and there, that's due to me. I just want to also point out that each week they had a budget of $17,500, which apparently was not a whole lot. And that surprised me because this is the early 50s. And the other fascinating concept is that there were seven staff people from CBS who lived, not lived, but they had offices in the American Museum of Natural History during this period. And even more interesting, inhabited what we now consider the prime real estate in that building. It's where development is currently based. So you can imagine how kind of elegant, architecturally elegant those spaces were. So they had free rein, which is an absolutely unheard of notion, standing from 2006. And this is also the same time period, for those of you who saw Good Night and Good Luck, you know, the CBS staff that was working out of those offices who were dealing with all the issues of McCarthyism, et cetera. Well, this other staff was based in the museum trying to tease out how to express aspects of science and culture, you know, pre-Sputnik, Cold War era. And I'm going to start just showing some segments. The first is under that rubric of science on scientists on TV, and it's with a herpetologist, Charles Bogart. The interviewer is Shad Northfield, and what's interesting about him is he became one of the founders of CBS Sunday Morning, and for those of you who have ever watched it, that whole natural moment that concludes that series was essentially born out of that experience with adventure. And finally, the host of this series was Charles Collingwood, who was a sort of like the Peter Jennings of that era, so a dapper newscaster who traveled the world. And as my informants like to tell me, he always went to London to get his suits tailored. So we're going to start with the snake segment.
Well, as for me, I'll go along with the majority of people. I can get along without snakes, and I must say, they seem to be able to get along pretty well without me. I'm not squeamish, but I like to keep my distance. However, there are people here in the museum who fool around with snakes, and they tell me that the snake has been grossly maligned ever since Adam's time, and that a great many grievances have been unjustly attributed to the snake. So we thought that we might clear up some misconceptions about the reptile group today. And down there, way down there at the other end of the studio, are a couple of gentlemen who are handling snakes, and I will happily turn that task over to them.
It seemed almost certain that they were sensory organs, but for years no one could figure out what they were for. It was known that they were lined with nerve endings, and yet no one could...
Well, what do they do with them? What you say that's a part of the feeding?
Well, they actually function as heat receptors, and since they're paired, he has one on each side. A snake can not only detect the presence of a warm-blooded animal, but he can direct his strike in complete darkness.
Even when he can't see. Can we prove that?
Well, I hope we can. We've got some rattlers over here, and if we can catch that big boy and blindfold it, I think we can give some idea of how that set of pits is going to function.
To him for quite a while. After you, sir.
Well, that's a fairly tough old rattler. It may give
us one.
In trouble. Bessie, if you'll bring in those blinds we've got ready, I'll see if we can blindfold our old boy. He may have other ideas. I think he does.
Yeah, he's not ready to cooperate.
Well, if the cameraman don't get worried and move out of here, I think I can protect this.
Catch.
And I hope the cameraman didn't scram at that stage.
Now, these are blindfolds you're putting over the eyes, but he still will be able, we think, to find objects through the use of those pits.
Yeah, we've got to be very careful not to cover up the pits. Now, we'll just cover up the eye.
Now, this blindfolding, does that hurt him at all?
No, snakes don't have any eyeball that's exposed. There's a scale over the eye. And of directing the strike. Now, first, we'll try this rattler with a balloon that's...
Well, he doesn't see it at all.
He's not aware of it,
no.
We'll bring this balloon in front of the snake. He's not aware of it. Now, Bessie, if you'll give me that balloon that has hot water in it, or warm water, and now he should be aware of that. He moves.
Sure is aware of it.
But he doesn't seem to have any desire to tangle with it. He's not going to strike it. Maybe we better pull out this other one we've got blindfolded and try it.
Well, we didn't manage to explode that balloon, but I hope we exploded some of the myths about the snake. Charles Collingwood, are you ready to come over to our side of the studio? Are you convinced now?
Well, I must say that you gentlemen have been very convincing, and I'm sure that the snake has been much maligned ever since the days of Adam and Eve. However, if you don't mind, I think that I will just stay where I am.
So it's in some ways it's not really fair that I showed this segment because obviously it's a failed experiment and many of them were successful.
That animal.
But it's a wonderful illustration of the challenges of live TV, and I'll get to even more extreme representation of that as we continue. What I'm going to do now is sort of it's a blend of two segments just because of the nature of the DVD. There was the next piece, which I'm only showing about a minute of, is hosted by George Gaylord Simpson, who is a celebrated paleontologist, and he's basically showcasing evolution from hundreds of thousands of years ago through back screen projection of evolution of how we reached where we are today. Along with brief introductions of the various subdivisions of the scientific departments. And so in a way, it's the biggest of the kind of puff pieces and celebration of AM&H. And what is amazing about that segment is that Einstein saw it, and he got really excited and called up, I don't know if it was the museum or CBS, and said he would be a willing participant on the adventure series, but at the time, this was during an era, the Cold War era, the museum refused his participation, which is only so funny in that in 2001 we did a major celebration of Einstein and had some of the best audiences ever, and he was, one of the most important figures in, if not 20th century, all of the scientific history. So it was that segment that got him motivated. And then we're going to bleed into the segment that I was making reference to, performing science. And maybe what I'll do is play it, and then I'll talk a little bit about it. So those next two segments, please.
Without backbones, dominated the Earth 500 million years ago. One of the group of animals who have no backbones is the insect. The study of contemporary animals of this sort is carried out by the Department of Insects and Spiders in the American Museum. Three members of this department are exploring the insect life of the western United States, but here is John Pallister, whose specialty is the study of beetles. The next oldest form which life took is that which we commonly call fish, animals with backbones who live underwater. 400 million years ago, life had evolved to this form. The study of life underwater is carried out by the museum's Department of Fishes. Representing this department is Dr. Albert E. Parr, one of the world's most distinguished marine biologists. Dr. Parr is also the director of the American Museum of Natural History. And if we may interrupt our program for just a minute, we'd like to thank Dr. Parr for his tact and his patience. He has helped to make Adventure the program it is by bringing the dissimilar worlds of science and showmanship together. Well, one of the museum's most unusual departments is that which is called the Department of Animal Behavior. This is Dr. Evelyn Shaw, Mrs. Rosalind Warren,
chromosomes. Charles, am I going too fast for you?
Well, it's not that you're going too fast, Dr. Shapiro. It's that you've been running backwards, and I must confess it's difficult to follow a man who's running backwards. Now, let's see. We went from the baby backwards to the embryo, from the embryo to the fetus, from the fetus backward to the fertilized multicells, and then to the single cell. We saw fertilization and decided to follow the male sperm. So we went backwards from the sperm, the germ cell, which gives rise to the sperm. Is that right?
You're running backwards admirably, Charles. And now we're going to have a look at the chromosomes within the germ cell of the father. We've had to simplify things here for the purposes of this discussion. But in a moment, we'll see those chromosomes once more. In the human germplasm, there are 48 chromosomes. Because of restrictions of time, budget, and simplicity, we've reduced the number to 10. And if we look at these chromosomes carefully, we'll see something about heredity right away. If we look at a chromosome under a microscope, we'll see many stripes on each chromosome. These stripes, called genes, look like gelatinous beads, and they're probably highly complex protein molecules. But it's the genes that control heredity. The slightest difference in those stripes, or genes, makes the greatest difference in what kind of person you are. We think there are over 24,000 genes carried by each human. And each string of genes, each chromosome, controls factors that no other duplicates. These genes and chromosomes represent everything that a father can pass on by heredity to his son. Let's look at the characteristics the father is capable of passing on. Just before this germ cell became a sperm cell, the strings of chromosomes pair off. And if we've lettered the chromosomes from A to Y, and except for X and Y, each of the 48 has its mate. That makes sense because the father himself has received an equal number of chromosomes from his father and from his mother. Now let's see what the father's own inheritance has been in part. The father's father has genes which carry brown eyes. The father's mother has genes which carry blue eyes. The father's father has genes which carry brown straight hair. The father's mother has genes which carry curly blonde hair. The father's father has genes which carry the blood type A, and the father's mother has genes which carry the blood type B. The father's father has genes which carry dark skin. And the father's mother has genes that carry light skin. And now something quite different. There is one set of chromosomes which is not a pair. There is a single X chromosome and a single Y chromosome. The X chromosome determines that the offspring will be a girl. It is carried by both males and females. The Y chromosome determines that the offspring will be a boy. It is only carried by males. This means that it is the father that determines the sex of the child. This, of course, is just a partial, minute list of the characteristics which the father has inherited from his father and his mother. Remember, there are 48 of these chromosomes, not just the 10 we see. Remember, too, there are thousands and thousands of inheritable factors, not just the few we've mentioned.
So, pretty amazing, and particularly because they wanted to do animation and couldn't afford it. So this was the alternative to animation, and if only we had a lot less money, which I know we can't imagine having any less than we have, but the ways that the lack of funds can really push you to be inventive in illustrating aspects of whether the genetic story or other stories. Now, Jack Venza was really critical in helping to bring together a lot of like local performers and dancers that he was involved with. And what's also great is that Joseph Papp was the floor manager for this and some of the other performance efforts. So again, like a lot of these major people were involved in the series very early on. Another tidbit that was shared is in the 1950s, CBS wouldn't have blacks on television. And so the only way they could include these artists and performers were whether wearing, like masks or headdresses, and or they actually, there's a lot of shadow play as ways to illustrate aspects of culture and performance in the adventure series, because of course there were so many major black performance groups, you know, in the city that they wanted to have participate. So again, having to kind of negotiate, navigate how to get different kinds of communities on television. The next segment I'm going to show is also another performance segment, but this is dealing with music and culture. And in a way, I'm not showing what the centerpiece of this project, which is that Perry Wolff had come to know the composer Samuel Barber and asked him if he would be willing to, they got permission to take the African musical instruments out from behind the glass and compose a piece and have it performed. But in all honesty, and for purposes of this event, it's not the most engaging, but it's just fascinating that there was that kind of, you know, art and cultural collaboration. But the bigger story of Western versus non-Western musical traditions are the fascinating aspect of the story. And this is the longest of the segments I'm going to show, and it runs about 10 minutes.
Hours of adventure, and to celebrate our long and happy life, we put down our scientific instruments and picked up musical ones. We've gone through the dark vaults of the American Museum of Natural History and taken from them some of the most exotic musical instruments ever devised by primitive man. We called on one of America's finest composers, Samuel Barber, and asked him whether he'd write us a composition using these primitive and Western instruments. He did, and he called it Adventure, which pleases us mightily. John Butler choreographed it. What's the difference between primitive and Western instruments? What do they look like? What do they sound like? How are they used? Well, we've called on Dr. Willard Rhodes, an anthropologist and musicologist of Columbia University, to introduce us to the world of Western and primitive music. Here's Dr. Rhodes and a not-so-primitive instrument.
This, of course, is a piano. And a piano is either a musical instrument or a torture device, depending on how old you are and how many hours a day you must practice. The piano keyboard with its series of black and white keys is a visual graph of the resources of Western music. Except for variations in tone color and the limitations of a two-handed, ten-fingered performer, almost everything written for our music can be played on a piano. It is not only a voice which speaks music, it is a chart of music as well. And as we take our own language for granted, we take the notes of a piano for granted. Let's look at the instrument as a graph. Let's go up the chart, note by note. Now, from the first note to the second is a whole step. From the second to the third, a whole step. From the third to the fourth, a half step, since there's no black key. From the fourth to the fifth is a whole step. From the fifth to the sixth, a whole step. From the sixth to the seventh, a whole step. But from the seventh to the eighth, again, since there's no black key, is only a half step. That's the pattern of all major scales. Now, if you take this basic pattern and start on any other key, you'll have an equivalent scale, no matter where you begin. Let's start on a black key. Whole step. Whole step. Half step. Whole step. Whole step. Whole step. Whole step. Half step. Same pattern, same scale, but a half tone higher. These major scales and their relative minor scales are the basis of most traditional Western music. They sound normal and correct to our ears, and we have the feeling they're perfectly natural. Relative minor scales which provide the material from which our melodies and harmonies are created. Now let's talk about chords, harmonies. For instance, if you put the first, the third, the fifth, and the eighth. If you put these tones of the scale together, you get a major chord. In Western music, if you put the second, the fourth, the fifth, and the seventh tones together, you get what is called the dominant seventh chord. The dominant seventh chord, to our ears, seems to anticipate the tonic major chord. Just like that. Now the scales and harmonies I've shown you sound as natural to our ears as the English language. And we're prone to forget that both our musical language and our spoken tongue are man-made conventions. It's the same thing with rhythms. We think our rhythms are perfectly understandable to everyone. But even our simplest rhythms are conventions, agreed upon. For instance, take the construction of a waltz. A waltz is a dance in triple meter with an accent on the first beat. Another of our conventional meters consists of four evenly spaced beats with a stress on the first and third beats. It's most familiar as the march. March and the waltz are not native to America, but some rhythmic figures are peculiarly American. This is a figure you'll probably recognize. These are blues. It is music spoken with an American accent, but it is derived from Africa. Blues are not strict about conventional diatonic scales. There seems to be a tendency to look for tones which lie outside our musical system. Modern composers, both serious and popular, are looking for tones which do not exist on the piano. new tones, new colors, new combinations, and new forms. The search for them goes on. Primitive music depends heavily on rhythm. So much of primitive rhythm has crept into our Western music in the last 50 years that it might be of interest to look at some African drums. Here is a small slit drum. Let's hear the sound of this. Here is another Congo drum. Large standing animal form. You'll note that it's slit down the center, and it has this tone on one side. On the other side, another tone. The next instrument is called a pressure drum. It comes from the Yoruba tribe in Nigeria and is an ancestor of the modern kettle drum. It is carved from wood in the form of an hourglass. There are two skin heads bound together by these leather thongs. And by varying the pressure on the head of the drum, it's possible to change the pitch from low tones to high, like this. These talking drums are much used in the West African drum language. Finally, from Africa also is the instrument which Mr. Barber uses to open his composition, Adventure. It's called a sansa. Extremely delicate and quite small, as you can see. It's actually a kind of portable piano, and its tones sound like this. We've made the point so far that musical patterns and musical tones of primitive instruments are not the same as in our Western music. One of the great differences between African and Western music is that the meters or rhythms in African music often overlay each other. This is called polyrhythm or polymeter. It's something like beating a waltz rhythm in 3/4 time and then playing a march rhythm in 4/4 time right over the waltz. Perhaps it is best illustrated by using Mr. Barber's musicians. Let's start with one rhythm on the small slit drum, this one. Let's play a second rhythm now on another drum. Here's a third rhythm. And a fourth rhythm on one side of the large slit drum. And finally, a fifth rhythm on the other side of the same drum. Now let's add these instruments together one at a time, and you'll hear how complex polyrhythms can become. Polyrhythm.
And now we're going to move to our last segment.
His sleds, and now he could.
We're going to move to our last segment, which is science and celebrity. And what I mean by celebrity is that people like Eleanor Roosevelt, Edward Steichen, Chief Justice William O. Douglas, who had climbed Annapurna, were involved with Adventure. But the most interesting is that Frank Lloyd Wright came to the museum and did an interview. They had done a pre-interview to illustrate the way that his architecture had been influenced by Mayan architecture. And you see what happens when an associate producer takes someone out for a drink before a live shoot on television. So with that, I'll let the piece speak for itself.
Startling resemblances to some of the Maya architecture which we've seen, some of the Maya temples that we've been looking at. Frank Lloyd Wright is about to open an exhibition of his life work in a pavilion which he specially designed here in New York. And for that exhibition, he chose to flank the entrances to it two works of art of Maya. Now, Mr. Wright, would it be accurate for me to say that you have been influenced by ancient Maya architecture?
No, my dear boy, I don't think it would be quite accurate. Come something by way of architecture.
Mr. Wright, these temples that we have seen have lasted for 1,000 years. Do you think that your own architecture will remain meaningful 1,000 years from now?
I do, at least. Let's say 1,000 years, because democracy has never yet built. And when democracy does build, and I think she's beginning to build in this organic architecture, we'll have an architecture by way of which even the Mayan would resolve itself into the background completely.
Thank
you. Because we have the methods, we have the means, we have the capacity. The Mayans didn't have it.
Thank you very much,
You're
Mr.
Entirely
Wright.
Welcome.
And I think that we can see a community of inspiration between the work of Frank Lloyd Wright and the work of the ancient Maya. What is good, true, real, and honest then is still good, true, real, and honest today.
Ground into the light.
That is the same principle, which you have. I think there are two things that we can learn from our adventure today into the remoteness of the American past. One is that a civilization, no matter how incandescent, can suddenly go dark. An accident of nature or the folly of man can undo the work of genius that's been done so patiently. And the second thing is this, that ideas don't die. Ideas go on. The cities and buildings, Mr. Wright, of ancient Maya lie moldering in the jungle. But the inspiration of the Maya is still here, the inspiration which moves some people and stirs the imagination of others, still goes on. Part of the treasure house of ideas, which is the most priceless heritage of mankind.
There's nothing more to say. Thanks.